Our website, alternativeradio.org.
I wanted to ask you about how the figure of the doubleganger helps you get to all of these conclusions and also issue these warnings about what's going on. I'm just curious about how your story about Wolf is not a specific story. It's not a personal story. It's actually a story about how it is also a universal story. It's about how societies and countries have become double gangers of themselves, right? Whether it's Israel, whether it's the United States, whether it's, you know, or any other society. Yeah. And you say on page 274, what if the full-blown fascism is not the monster at the door, but the monster inside the house, the monster inside of us, right? This is the biggest danger, right? Sort of, we follow you in the story about Wolf, but we shouldn't really just stay there, obviously.
What I realized was that having a doppelganger was a sort of, my friend Keel McClear, who's a wonderful writer, talked about it as a narrow aperture that could let me look at a few different things. I'd wanted to return to the subject of personal branding, for instance, because a brand is kind of a double that we make of ourselves, right? My first book was about branding, but it came out, you know, in 2000, and there was pre-iPhone, it was pre-social media, it was not yet possible for all of us to be brands. I mean, when I wrote No Logo, Michael Jordan was a brand, but, you know, English professors were not brands, you know? But suddenly we all ended up with advertising companies in our back pockets, and they told us it was free. They didn't tell us they were going to hoover up all the data and make doppelgangers of us using AI, but that's a whole other story, right? So what I realized is, oh, this is interesting. I have a branding problem. There's another Naomi who people think is me, and she's doing all kinds of wild things, and people keep screaming at me on the internet about it. But then I'm like, well, is that me on the internet, or is that a doppelganger of me, and who are any of us? And this was like, you know, deep pandemic thinking. And so I realized I could get back at this subject, but not do it from the outside, kind of do it from the inside, right, where we're all implicated, right? It's easy to be like, oh, you are the brand, and I am a true human. But we're all, of none of our choosing, all trying to kind of get by. And I think the impulse to perfect the self is really an impulse really to survive when so much security has been stripped away in this economic model. We're trying to build our little branded lifeboats, right? So part of how I mapped this was by reading a lot of books about doppelgangers and watching a lot of films about doppelgangers and calling it research. So, you know, I read Dostoevsky, The Double, and Saramago, and watched Charlie Chaplin's The Great Dictator, and a lot of Jordan Peele. And, you know, what you realize is that many artists have used the figure of the doppelganger to explore fascism, to explore this feeling of, like, you know, Freud talked about how we're drawn to the doppelganger because the doppelganger stands in for the lives we might have lived, right? Like, we know that even though we live in a system that tells us that we are all, you know, authors of our own destiny and responsible for all of our successes, you know, that our lives could be so different. The person we are is not the result just of our own actions. It's the result of these accidents of birth and decisions that our parents and grandparents made and the systems we were born into and the privileges and the lack thereof that bestowed on us. So this idea that there's another you walking around that other people think are you stands in for this feeling of, like, is there, like, could I be someone else, right? And also, like, could I be someone worse? Am I not the person who I think I am? And so the reason why I say it's, you know, it can't just be about her is that one of the things I learned from reading a lot of doppelganger literature is that often they follow the stories follow a certain arc where, like, somebody realizes there's another them walking around and they just go off on a self-righteous journey to confront their doppelganger and perhaps kill them. And this invariably leads to the protagonist being dead on the ground because the doppelganger is always them. Like, the doppelganger is you. It's holding up a mirror going, do you like what you see? You can't stab your doppelganger, even if you would like to. You have to actually see what your doppelganger is showing you, parts of yourself that you don't want to see. Like, you know, there's so much talk of fascism in the moment that we're in. Is he or isn't he? That this should be a moment where we really look at ways in not just that they are acting like fascists, but that we might be.
Yeah. you know, you mentioned Walter Benjamin's famous line of every document of civilization is necessarily and always a document of barbarism. And also, you know, Aimé Césaire, who said very eloquently, he said that colonialism, modernity, and fascism are all just a snaking old story, right? It's like these are things that are happening. We are not better than other people. We're not better than other cultures. We think that we are, and we want to teach them all kinds of lessons. But we should also check in the fascism at the door.
I think this was the part of the research that was most important for me personally, and that has been most orienting in terms of understanding the moment. You know, the book came out a month before October 7th, you know, and that has helped me sort of understand the rise of the far right globally, helped me to understand the ways in which people I know and grew up with are rationalizing atrocities right now. And that is, you quoted Cesar and Benjamin. I went to a Jewish day school. I thought I understood what the Holocaust was and what fascism was. It turns out I was not exposed to a huge body of literature that, and neither was almost anyone I know, which is embarrassing, you know, including my parents who are lefties, you know, but all of these anti-colonial thinkers in the 30s and 40s were saying about the rise of fascism in Europe that this is not new. This is not a rupture. This is imperialism, colonialism, boomeranging, in Cesare's words, back to Europe. Now, I know there are many scholars in this room who are familiar with this literature. I was not. The literature I grew up with was the Holocaust was a rupture in time and space. Once again, a shock without history. In fact, to compare it with any other genocide was anti-Semitic. There was, you know, in the words of Claude Lanzmann, a ring of fire around the Holocaust. And so even like to do any, like he was talking about filmmaking, but you can't go into it, you can't understand it, like that there was a forbidding. In fact, Lanzmann used this sentence to describe, Claude Lanzmann made this landmark documentary series called Shoah, which was how a lot of people learned about the Holocaust. It was 9.5 hours, and Lanzmann was a contemporary of Sartre, a colleague, and Beauvoir. He was in the French Resistance. He made this landmark film. But this was a really, really key part of how he explained the Holocaust to the world. He used this phrase, here there is no why. Here there is no why about Auschwitz and about the Holocaust. The phrase comes from Primo Levi, who was in Auschwitz, and he was quoting a guard saying, here there is no why. So if anyone is asking why they're there, and the answer was, here there is no why. So a guard's answer to a prisoner becomes why we're not allowed to say why, how, can we compare, how did it happen? So W.E.B. Du Bois, Cesar, Benjamin, later Arendt, many others, we're trying to understand the lineages of European fascism. And the lineages are in settler colonialism here. Hitler was very open about what he learned from the Jim Crow South, from eugenics here. The whole idea of Lebensraum expanding, getting elbow room to the east, was built on the Western frontier. I mean, it was an expansion of that, but also the German genocide of the Nama and Herero in what is now Namibia. After the First World War, Germany lost its colonies, including in Africa, and so decided to expand eastward, right? So there are all of these, like, not wavy lines, but straight lines from colonialism in the global south and settler colonialism here and in Australia and Canada. And it was not part of our Holocaust education, which means we don't know. I mean, we watch all these interviews. Is he a fascist? People do not know what fascism is. They're acting as if it has to be a replica of Hitler and Mussolini, as opposed to something that is deeply encoded in our histories, right? That has always been here. Even this idea, could it happen here? It never happened here. It happened here. And so if we don't understand that fascism, it has always been our twin, right? And this is what Jordan Peele is trying to show us with all the doubles, then how will we recognize it? Doppelgangers help.
Very much so. I want to get to Palestine and Israel. October 7 was a terrible day, no matter which way you look at things. But when I see the reaction to October 7, or what preceded October 7, the dehumanization, the decontextualization, the banalization of suffering, the use of divine prophecy to call some children children of light and others children of darkness, unleashing the worst military power on civilians, this license to kill, maim, erase, evict, and disregard international law, the suppression of speech, the denial of Palestinian tears and grief, and the callous indifference and direct support of our government. How do we ever reach a resolution when this level of toxic doubling of the ethnic other is happening?
Well, thank you for that. How do we do it? I mean, I think partly, you know, what I was saying before about how we respond to this moment, how we meet this moment. First, we do have to look, and I know a lot of people have, you know, it becomes too much and you look away. And if you are one of those people who've stopped looking, I would really implore you to look. I mean, I don't think we need to be marinating in the images all the time, but I think we can go to trusted sources. Good journalism. I think The Guardian's been doing some very good reporting. I think Al Jazeera's been doing some very good reporting. And understand that we are in a new phase right now where those early statements of intent that form part of South Africa's genocide case before the ICJ, quoting all of these Israeli officials saying what they plan to do in Gaza, is now happening in northern Gaza right now. You know, more than 1 million people are at risk of starvation. All of the hospitals are under attack, are not functioning. And so I hope people do look and think about what we're called to do. There is no justification for genocide. It's why we have a genocide convention. We can't hide behind, well, they did that and they want to do this. It doesn't matter. There is no justification for genocide. This is how a culture is erased. It is very, very deliberate, and it's happening before our eyes. So this is why what we do now really matters. It also matters how we treat each other. You know, I think that there are some things we can control, and there's some things we can't control. You know, there are things that we can demand of our government in terms of a weapons embargo. I mean, this has to be the number one demand, is to stop arming the state. It's your taxpayers, it's your weapons, your tax dollars and your weapons, all of ours, really. I'm an American as well. But then I also think that we have to model another way to be with one another, you know, in our movements, in our social movements. You know, and as a Jewish person who, I'm part of an anti-war movement, I'm part of a, you know, movement against apartheid, occupation. I've been on the board of Jewish Voice for Peace for 15 years, and the way I see the work with Jewish Voice for Peace is partly a response to, you know, what I see as, you know, sometimes called Judeo-pessimism, similar to Afro-pessimism, right? This idea that Jew hatred is eternal, primordial, and so powerful that you can't respond to it with any of the usual tools. We're never going to be free of these hatreds, but there are things that we can do in terms of actually respecting universal human rights and commitments to equality before the law and real solidarity in ways that we can show up for one another that can mitigate them in very serious ways, right? And I really do believe in that multiracial, multiethnic alliance. And that's a big part of the Jewish tradition, particularly before the Holocaust. And after the Holocaust, many of the people who were part of fighting for those multiethnic futures were annihilated, but, you know, they were annihilated in the Holocaust, they were annihilated in Stalin's camps. And so it sort of seemed like Zionism was the only possible response left, an ethno state. So I don't believe in that ethno state, and I believe it was always leading to this moment. But when I say that, that also means that I need to be fighting for Jews to be safe here, right? Because a big part of Zionism's argument is that you need an ethno-state because Jews will never be safe. There will always be another Holocaust around the corner, right? And so I think really fighting for one another and really committing ourselves to one another's, you know, our mutual liberation and safety is part of fighting that here, right? So I think what can we control? We can fight to stop sending the weapons. We can divest. And we can model what it means to fight hatred, all forms of hatred, anti-Palestinian hatred, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, anti-Black racism, all of it, right, in coalition with one another, and build real cultures of care. And that's really hard work. It's really hard work during a genocide. And I think it might be even more important in those moments when it's hard.
So Q&A, who has a question?
Great. Hi, thank you. I have a question about related and different, relating to sort of the shock doctrine in light of a lot of the news coming out of what happened post-Helene with the disinformation and Russian hackers. And I'm curious just your thoughts in general about this sort of new political disinformation doppelganger, how the two relate for you. But also putting it into the lens of the way you were just speaking about Gaza, of what can we do and what should we do? Because I think what can we do is looking at the Russian framework and outside actors, but I'm curious into your thoughts of sort of the relational, what should we do? Thank you.
I think there are a lot of different players, and the fact that Elon Musk is, you know, fired all the content moderators and wants to amplify, is personally amplifying this, is, you know, that's a domestic problem, you know, that he was allowed to buy Twitter in the first place, and that this is so deregulated, you know, to the degree that, you know, when he bought Twitter, he said it, he wanted it because it was the global town square, right? So I think we need to start thinking about what it means to have an information commons. You know, this really is a public good, and it needs to be treated and regulated as such. And it's simply, you know, wild that one person could just buy it and turn it into their plaything and amplify disinformation. You know, he amplified the, you know, the FEMA spending money on migrants lie. But also, I mean, what we need to do is not give in to this sort of like, oh, they like they're the crazy people. We know everything is fine, you know, because everything is not fine. We need to talk about climate change, and we need to talk about what we're going to do in the face of climate change, and we need to talk about the conspiracies that are peer-reviewed and that we can prove and that we know about, including the fact that Trump brought, you know, I think it was 10 oil executives to Mar-a-Lago and promised them if they gave him $1 billion, he would roll back Biden's entire environmental agenda. You know, that's kind of conspiratorial, you know? It's just normalized conspiracy. So we need to kind of denormalize that because it should not be allowed. So I think this brings us to like what, you know, what are the priorities? Money in politics, I think having an actual like healthy information ecology, investing in reliable media is important, you know, various kinds. So
we live in a democracy. We believe in the idea that we can vote and we can elect people into power. We want to talk about, like, you know, functional media, et cetera. But we don't live in any of that right now. And we're watching infrastructures that were backstops come undone. And so one of the things I'm curious about is, as you're thinking about this, how do we get past, like, it would be great if we had functioning media. It would be great if we had functioning Congress. And where are, in your mind, some of the more tactical things that can be done, as we're not just seeing the challenges that are the big screen TV challenges, but the genuine infrastructural erosion challenges?
I think different things are possible depending on different electoral outcomes. I'm not sure I know exactly how to fix America right now. I know that it says that I'm going to get you back to stable ground, but I mean, we are pretty far gone. Like, we're pretty deep in the rubble. You know, this is why, you know, that Walter Benjamin quote, I mean, it really is, it's about the angel of history, and it's about the fact that it's cumulative, right? I mean, our defeats add up, and we don't get to the blank sheet where we're just like, make everything perfect. We need to build power, and I don't think there are any shortcuts to that. In really building institutional power, whether it's trade unions or organizations that are membership-based that we can rely on in these moments. Be suspicious when you see things online that seem to all be about tearing down the few institutions that we have left. Ask who would benefit if we had nothing we could rely on. You know, I was very active in the Bernie campaign, but I recognized that we were kind of skipping some phases of just kind of going straight for the presidency before we had really done that kind of ground up building. So I think that there are some exciting things that are happening with union organizing across the country, and we need to use our collective voices as much as we can.
I am a student here at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and I'm also like a pretty engaged in the student and community activism movements here, first in the climate movement and right now in the Palestine movement. And I'm actually like currently working with a couple of the students that were suspended recently too. And so as a veteran activist and organizer in a lot of these spaces, and who's written a lot about like of these groups that have faced oncoming repression, what kind of advice do you think you could give to students that are active in organizing here to create and promote that kind of progressive change?
That's a great question, and thanks for your organizing. I think there's strength in numbers. Having alliances that are intergenerational is also important. Some of the sturdiest activism that we've seen in this period are in places where students and undergrads and graduate students and faculty members have organized together and, you know, won some significant victories, even if not enough. I mean, I was recently at Cornell where a graduate student, Mamadou Tal, I don't know if he was completely suspended, but to the extent that he was going to be deported. And there was a huge petition. I think 10,000 people signed it. And they had to re-enroll him so that he wasn't going to be deported. So now he can stay and finish his PhD. So, I mean, it does show that despite the fact that these universities are very, very fearful, in particular, you know, they're afraid of donors, they're afraid of Congress, you know, people can organize and they can also be a force on campus that administrators have to respond to, right? This is just organized power that they are afraid of, and we need to be organized as well. That often does mean that not everybody is going to agree, right? And, you know, one of the ways that I look in the mirror and I'm concerned about what I see on our side is I really feel like we've lost the knack of debate within our ranks. Like, there's often a just kind of like, you know, this is like a maximalist position and everyone has to take that on, or they're not even worth engaging in. Then you end up with a small movement. I'm sorry, you know. I think we need to create on-ramps where people can get involved without already agreeing on everything. You know, this is something we do on the left. We didn't know it last week, but now we know it, and no one's allowed in who doesn't already know it. You know, this is like one of the things that I really love about like the film Israelism. I like it because it shows people changing their mind. It shows people who used to believe one thing and now they learned other things. Now they believe something else. It's not the only film we should be seeing. We should be seeing lots of films from a Palestinian perspective, but being able to see people change their minds in public, people change at university. It's one of the great things about universities. We get exposed to new worldviews and we change our worldview. But how do we do that, right? How do we do that in a way that is loving? And, you know, not everybody needs to play that role educating a newbie. For some people, that's going to be a lot more painful than others. But, you know, we need to organize so that there are people who do that work, right? So, yeah, like, what are the on-ramps? You know, what are the first steps? How do we create welcoming cultures that replenish us? Because it's hard, you know, it's hard. People are taking real risks. We need to actually even have fun. I know it sounds crazy, but I actually believe that as organizers, we need to create opportunities where we like cook together, have a nice time together, heal each other, like feel what we're actually feeling, create like soft spaces where you can actually talk and not yell into the void, you know, of social media. All those things help, like where it's like, well, imagine like building a movement where like it would be like somewhere that we would want to spend time. And I've seen some of that, but I've also seen the opposite, like really kind of punishing activist cultures. And I also get that because people are in so much goddamn pain, which is really understandable. And it often happens that when you're in pain, you just look to like have an effect on the people who you can hurt, which is not your university administrator, but is like probably somebody you're friends with. These are like my little pearls of wisdom from, you know, 30 years of activism. be a little bit nicer to each other if you can. Thank you so much.
You were just listening to Naomi Klein, What Are We Going to Do? She spoke at the University of Colorado at Boulder at the end of October. Naomi Klein is a professor at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Her writing has appeared in leading publications around the world. She's a columnist for The Guardian. She's the award-winning author of such bestsellers as This Changes Everything, No Logo, On Fire, and her latest book, Doppelganger. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Chris Hedges, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Noam Chomsky. And we have a series of Naomi Klein programs. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Naomi Klein, What Are We Going to Do?, and for her Doppelganger book, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Tim Butler. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Alicia Keys singing Bob Dylan's Pressing On.
Pressing on.